We are very pleased to have with us today Roland Miller. Roland Miller is currently visiting professor and coordinator of the Islamic Studies Program at Luther Northwestern Theological Seminary in St. Paul, Minnesota. He is also director of the institution's Global Mission Education Program. A Canadian, he is on 3 years' leave from his position as professor of Islam and world religions at Luther College, University of Regina. For many years, he serves as academic dean of the college and as the head of the university's religious studies program. From 1953 to 1976, he served as an LCMS ordained Lutheran missionary in India, where he was involved in a variety of evangelistic, medical, literary, administrative, and other church-related activities. Throughout that time, he and his wife, Mary Helen, who is a social worker, and their children resided in the Muslim-majority community of Malappuram in Kerala State, and they continue their long involvement with India through a variety of agencies and projects. Dr. Miller took his ministerial studies at Concordia Seminary in St. Louis and his MA and PhD in Islamic Studies from the Hartford Seminary Foundation. He is internationally known. He is an internationally known Islamicist with a specialization in Indian Islam and is regarded as the leading authority on the Mapilla Muslims of Kerala. He is the author of several books and many articles in the fields of Islamics, India Studies, and Missiology. Dr. Miller has now been invited to initiate the establishment of the first graduate Islamic Studies program in a Lutheran theological institution on this continent. Dr. and Mrs. Miller have 5 children, and he is a member of the Lutheran Church Canada. We welcome to our campus Dr. Roland Miller.
Brothers and sisters in Christ, thank you very much, Mr. Chairman, for your kind introduction, and my greetings to all of you, and my sincere expression of pleasure at the opportunity of being with you here, and thank you all for coming. This is like always homecoming for a graduate of this institution, and this particular room, which was the library where I studied, and the quadrangle where they kicked us out, and all the good things in related to Concordia Seminary are my heritage also, and I share that with you. Will rehearsing, remembering, and renewing. Rehearsing, remembering, and renewing. Those are the 3 words that I want to gear my thoughts and words around this morning with you. And there's quite a bit I want to share with you, so I will hurry on. I want to rehearse some things for you, first of all. I would like to start the rehearsal by reflecting on what I call student missionary power. Student mission power. What do I mean by that? Well, it's been students, I think, who have, in a sense, been the driving force of many great mission initiatives in the world. Not so long ago, I went to Williams College in Massachusetts, and you know about the Haystack event, and where 4 students gathered together, and there's started the North American Protestant Missionary Enterprise. There's a monument there, and I called, as the students were passing by, I called them over and said, hey, do you know what this monument is? And nobody knew. I said, here's where it all started. Here's where great things happened, and I'm not going to tell you what they are. one or two of them did. And then it was John R. Mott and the student voluntary movement that maybe excited 1,000 people to engage in the mission of the church. My story about student mission power is not so grand as that, but it's about the LCMS mission to Muslims. And I want to set what I'm about to say in a little bit of a historical context for you. The Missouri Synod work among Muslims began in the 1920s. It began with a person whose name may not be very well known to you. I think it will be known to some of you, however. And there's a lot of tragedy connected with it. His name is Adolph Brooks. Adolph Brooks was probably the most highly qualified missionary among Muslims ever to go out under Lutheran auspices from North America. He had his PhD from the University of Chicago in Arabic studies and was a very quality person. On his way to the mission field, which was in India, he stopped in Bombay, and at that time there was a prayer service, and the prayer service included Samuel Zwemer. Samuel Zwemer was a great Reformed Church in America missionary who inspired me personally to enter into the work among Muslims. And he got to me, not personally, but he got to me through a book, The Cross Above the Crescent. I hope you'll find it in your library. I've been prowling through the library, and there's some good books there. And The Cross Above the Crescent is one of them. And read Samuel Zwemer's interpretation of Isaiah 6 in relation to Islam and Muslims. I read that, and I couldn't resist what was in there. And, in fact, I got so excited that, not having any money at that time, I heard that Zwemer was speaking in Toronto in Canada. And so I got out in the highway and hitchhiked to Toronto and met him there. And 2 weeks later, he died. And that was a very thrilling, meaningful thing for me. Well, Dr. Brooks had a prayer with Samuel Zwemer on his way to Vanyambadi in the south of India. And he was cashiered because at that time, that was pre-1935, and Missouri Synod, the doctrine of prayer fellowship at that time, was not acceptable that you have private prayer with people of other denominations. That may sound strange to us now because there's a lot of history has come in between us. And as a result of that, he had to come home after his first period and was not sent back to India in 1935. At Cleveland, the Synod changed its policy on this. That wasn't soon enough to save Muslim missions, because Muslim missions in the Missouri Synod died. And when Dr. Brooks came back in 1969, the Synod extended an apology to Dr. Brooks. Then along came a very fabulous figure in the history of our church. His name was Dr. Henry Now. He had a PhD in Sanskrit. He was from Germany, and he came to India, became associated with our church, started mission work in several parts of India, and then came back and started a college in North Carolina, which was a breakthrough college for African Americans. And then a person from Nigeria came along and invited him to Nigeria. Dr. Now went to Nigeria, and so the Missouri Synod worked. And Nigeria was established in 1935 as a result of Henry Now. And through all these years, he'd met Muslims. And he said, why doesn't our church work among Muslims? And he came back and he started a campaign. Campaign would be, to put it mildly, a very, very strong person, this man. And he went up and down Missouri Synod, and he established a society called the Society for the Promotion of Muslim Missions, which produced a magazine called The Minaret. And very, very many people in the church associated with that. But no action was taken. And then it merged with student power, and back to my subject. And because he came to this campus, and he excited some of us. And we formed a society here. Dr. Wanyoung Ji and Dr. Nagel, who are here, remember that. And started a society. And we pestered the administration of the church. And to make a long story short, finally to get rid of us, they sent us overseas. You know, that's like, how, you know, you got to pay a price for student power. And so I'm calling for some student power on behalf of Muslims. Because I think it's got to come again from you. I think that for various reasons, and I pray for that. We got going then in the LCMS. It became a very formidable enterprise with missionaries and national church workers in India, in the Philippines, in Beirut, in the Middle East, in West Africa. And then, I'm sorry to say, things changed in our synod, and all the reasons for that are not yet quite clear, but a kind of a 20-year lacuna has set in which Muslims have tended to drop out of sight in the church body that was the leading Lutheran church in the world in this mission enterprise. And so we need student power or a prophet to say, arise, shine. Something to awaken the Missouri giant to a renewal of its awareness of the Muslim world. And the reason I say that is not out of a theology of glory, but because of the absolute essential quality of this enterprise, because this is now and recognized largely by many people, at any rate, the mega mission of the coming century. Here we have one-fifth of humanity, one-fifth of humanity. And as the very fine sermon said this morning, people who are ransomed by Christ and who are waiting for the message of that. And I call it the mega mission of the next century. And I think a mega seminary should be involved with a mega mission. Now, the purpose of this rehearsal of history is simply to say that we were in a leadership position in the mission to Muslims in the world, and I hope we can step back into a leadership position, step forward into a leadership position once again. For that, something has to happen where it started here at Concordia Seminary. So I come to the second point, which is remembering. And I want to call you to some remembering about Islam and the Muslim world. And I know that all of you are familiar to some extent with Islam, and many of you perhaps very well. And so forgive me if I don't take enough for granted. Let me say that interest in Islam has exploded in the Muslim world. And as I said to the faculty yesterday on being asked about it, there are many reasons for that. And probably started in 1979. With the taking of the hostages in Tehran. And then everybody began to gear up. And the intellectual world began to gear up. And classes in Islamic studies were started in universities and colleges in North America. And the commercial world geared up because you have to do business with oil-wealthy people. I remember when a sleazy character came to see me saying, I want the name of an oil sheikh. I said, why do you want the name of an oil sheikh? I want to do business with them. And I said, how much money do you have? And he said, $7 million. And I said, well, $7 million, the oil sheikhs, they spend that between two bites and morning tea. Come back when you have some real money. And I'll never forget the look on his face when he swiped that. It was a great moment in my life. I wouldn't have let him close to an oil. Commercial world geared up. Diplomatic world geared up. American State Department required 6 months of heavy work in Islam for anybody going abroad. Everybody geared up. Church lagged in the background. Still lags somewhat in the background. But now it's being forced forward by events of history. And I'm very happy to share with you good news from the ELCA that the ELCA has revised its whole mission priorities and distribution of funding and personnel in order to concentrate for the next 50 years on the Muslim world, a great event in Lutheran history. But I want our church to be there. Now, when you begin to think about being there, you have to recognize certain critical factors. And I'd like to put out four daunting or challenging factors that face any group of people that wants to begin taking this more seriously. I'd like to go through them one by one with you. The first daunting factor is the size of Islam. We speak of great bodies of people in the world, the mass of people in China, great mass of people in the former Soviet Union, great past mass of people in South Asia, and the great mass of Muslims. These are the great masses of society which we have to address more intelligently. But when we deal with such huge numbers, it's daunting. You know that there are over 1 billion Muslims in the world. Now, one out of every five human beings in the world is a Muslim. No longer is Islam something out there, something remote from American society. As you know, the TV is full of it, but our marketplaces are full of it, and our suburbs are full of it. And as I mentioned yesterday, the population of Islam in North America is a little difficult to identify because of the problem with census formats. But there are perhaps 5 to 7 million Muslims in North America. It is a rapidly growing entity, and maybe the second largest religion in this country in just a few years. And I don't see how you can, any of you in the room, can even think of doing ministry in contemporary United States without taking this reality under some sort of consideration. I spoke at a group recently. I said, why are you here? And four of the people, it's a very straight group of people, older group of people, four of the families had intermarriages with a son-in-law or a daughter-in-law with Muslims. I attended a dialogue on intermarriage in Chicago, which attempted to draw together Muslims and Christians. Now, how are we going to sort this out? There are between 50 and 75 people there discussing what are now the parameters of behavior in reference to Christian Muslim intermarriage. These are pastoral problems of considerable significance apart from the missionary task itself. Not only is Islam immense in numbers, but it's immense in history, in culture, in civilization. There are 46 Muslim, more than 46 Muslim majority countries in the world. That means that there's a vast body of cultural material to deal with, a vast civilizational achievement to consider. Not only is it large in history, culture, and civilization, but it's large in theology. The theological enterprise of Islam has been very, very huge. When I deal with it, I usually divide it into three portions: Islamic theology, philosophy, and mysticism. And each one of those would take a full year in a normal, if you'd really want to do it well, in a normal university setting. Now we have to deal with those theological realities. Islam has faced every question practically that Christianity, that Christian theology has faced, almost every theological question you can name, only without a high Christology. Now, in started to understand then the significance and importance of Christology within Christian theology. There is nothing better for you than to look at how Muslims dealt with those problems without that high Christology. When we deal with size, what do we do? Well, I think one simple thing that I suggest is not to think of Islam at all. When you think of Islam, you think of a system, a highly developed, huge system of thought, a very self-assured, a very self-conscious system of thought, a huge mass of humanity. You think of Islam that way, there's something daunting about it, I'll admit. So I say think of Muslims, because Muslims is the adjective. Muslims are the people, human beings, next door to you probably here in the city, and all over the world, ordinary human beings, with eyes and ears and nose and mouth, same problems we have as human beings, wondering how to get a job, wondering how to educate their children, wondering how to survive sickness, wondering about their eternal fate. All the same questions you and I have. Think of them not as Muslims, not as representatives of a system, but as human beings who need you. The second daunting factor in Islam is its mystery. Any religion that is not very familiar to us has a mysterious component to it. The unknown always seems a little mysterious. I think you can say that about Islam, but in a way, you have to say it in a very modified sense, because I don't think of Islam as mysterious at all. If I'd be talking about Hinduism or Buddhism, I suppose the word mystery would really be appropriate. But when you think of Islam, it's perhaps the least mysterious of the world religions. Let me start, just to run that past you, let me start with three English letters, S-L-M, S-L-M. Those three, St. Louis on the Mississippi, I just saw that, that's okay. S-L-M, and I can remember that, S-L-M. And those are the same letters essentially that you find in Shalom in Hebrew. And so you think of the meanings associated with Shalom, you transfer those meanings as well as the sound to the Arabic. Arabic is the sacred language of Islam. You have to be careful not to identify Islam with Arabs. Arabs represent only 15% of the Muslim world. The vast body of the Muslim world lies beyond the Middle East. This is one of the caricatures that we're fighting in this thing. Which is the largest Muslim country in the world? Anybody? Thank you. Great. Indonesia, of course. And South Asia, and so on. But Arabic is the sacred language because the scripture is written in Arabic, and therefore everybody likes the language. And so you use Arabic terminology a great deal. And SLM incorporate the essential theology of Islam. You have it in the greetings. You know that when Muslims greet each other, when Jews greet each other, what do they say? They say, Shalom Aleichem, peace be with you. And when Muslims greet each other, they say exactly the same thing. Salam Aleikum. Salam Aleikum. Okay, Salam is Shalom. And Aleikum is with you. And then when somebody says that, the other person responds by saying, Wa, which means and, Wa Aleikum, turn it around, Salam. So the first person says, Salam Aleikum, and the second person responds, Wa Aleikum, Salam. So I'm going to do that with you. Okay, I'm going to say it first. Salam Aleikum. Now you give it to me. Wa alaikum salam. And when you get close enough to a Muslim to be able to do that with a Muslim, that is very, very special. That is very, very special. If you do it without knowing them, they'll faint. I wonder, you know, where you discovered that. And SLM. That's SLM. Salam. SLM. What is the root meaning of SLM? Two root meanings. The one that we're probably most familiar with is peace, because we just said peace be with you. But underneath that is another meaning. And the underneath meaning is surrender. Surrender. Surrender to God. Surrender. And the second derived meaning is peace. So when you said Salaam Alaikum to me just now, you said, I wish you the peace that comes from surrendering to God. Isn't that great? Of course it is. It's very nice. And to you I wish the peace that comes from surrendering to God. So what is the word for God? The word for God is Allah. And don't be worried about that word. That word is used for translating the Arabic into the New Testament. So all Arab Christians say Allah. It's a generic word for the deity, the God. All right, what can you say about God? Well, Muslims are very careful here. They don't like to talk about God in terms of limiting or defining characteristics very much. They are very, very afraid of bringing God down to the level of humanity. They're very, very afraid of human language as a defining and a limiting factor in God. God is majestic. Be careful with your language. Well, what can you say? You can say that God is one. That is essential for Muslims, that there is no one else in the category of God. And the second thing that you can say is that God is powerful. There is nothing beyond the limits of God's ability and authority, both. And the third thing that you can say is summed up in the term ruler, that God rules the universe. And he rules it in terms of three things. He's the creator, he's at the beginning of things, and he's the judge, and he's at the end of things, and he is the middle, sovereign will and activity, the actual ruler of human events. And then Islam carefully stops at that point, is very chary about going on beyond that. So then what is the basis of my relationship with God, which is awesome, overwhelming, epitome of transcendency? What is my relationship? Well, what could it be except for servant, to be the servant of God? Now we know that in Christian theology and Christian expression, it is the word child of God that sums up our understanding of the relationship between the divine and the human. But for Muslims, no, this is too intimate, too close, too daring, too presumptuous. The servant, the glory of humanity, to be the servant of God, and therefore the relation of command. God is the master, I am the servant. God gives command. I strive to obey them. And it is not, therefore, unexpected that that law should be a primary category in Islam. It is. Law is gospel in Islam. Law serves the function of gospel in Islam. That forces you to think differently when you try to meet a Muslim, because law is not a curse. Law is gospel for Muslims. Therefore, you have to relate to that somehow. So then I strive to obey the commands of God. But human beings have a problem. And the problem is their anthropology, their orientation as human beings. For Christian and Muslim anthropology are fundamentally different at this point. For Islam says that human beings have in them both the inclination towards good and the inclination towards evil. Those two inclinations, towards good and evil, are both part of the created action of God. And so we have a problem right from the beginning, the problem of obedience. Our relationship is one of command and obedience. We must obey. And at the end says, the Quran, the judgment day, and the judgment is pictured in very, very, very graphic terminology. How can I tell you of the calamity of the judgment day? That day when every soul that has done an atom's weight of good shall behold it, and every soul that has done an atom's weight of evil shall behold it. How shall I tell you of the calamity on that day when no burdened one shall bear another's burden? Oh, the calamity of that day. As Muslims go towards that hour, that day of reckoning, that's what they need help. And here is where the Muslim concept of mercy comes in. Because at the beginning of every chapter of the Quran, except one, are the words Bismillahirrahmanirrahim, which means in the name of God, the merciful and the compassionate. So God is mercy. What does humanity need, says God? Humanity needs guidance. Humanity needs clarity as to how to behave. Humanity should be behaving, but they don't seem to behave. Therefore, I will provide guidance. And so the mercy of God is fulfilled in the concept of hidayat, guidance, the primary concept in Islam. And so from the beginning of humanity, God has chosen to give his guidance to humanity. How does God give guidance? God gives guidance through prophets and through books. So Adam was the first prophet in Islam, and Noah the second. And so on down the line, names that would be very, very familiar to you, 17 prophets. The 17th one being Jesus. And his name is Isa. Isa Messiah, the Messiah. And he's also called the Word and the Spirit of God. And so the history of humanity is a history of rise and fall. Humanity falls. God gives a prophet. Humanity rises again temporarily. Falls again. God, in his mercy, gives another prophet. And so it went on, up and down, and up and down. And through Jesus, then, the children of Israel turned away again after Jesus. And so God, as it were, became tired. Became tired of it all. Humanistic language for Muslims. But that is, in effect, the theology. God said, now I will do the hapax thing once and for all. And so God chose a person in the 6th century, in the 7th century in Arabia, whose name is Muhammad. And through him, he gave his final revelation, which is called the Quran. And the Quran says, now it is enough for you. The guidance is complete. God's mercy is completed in this final act of guidance, which is his greatest gift to humanity. And so, you are thinking, I hope you are thinking, what is my greatest understanding of God's greatest gift to humanity? And I think you know the answer to that, but this is the whole point of the Christian mission in the Muslim world. That Muslims regard guidance and moral legislation as God's final and ultimate gift, and you and I think that God, when he said, I will send to them my son. The third daunting thing. I just say, how do you deal with mystery? This isn't a mystery. That's why I said it's not very mysterious, rather straightforward. But I think there are things to learn, and I've oversimplified it. And so how you deal with mystery is really to engage in some learning. And I really think it is rather important that you understand some more things about the religious affiliation of one-fifth of humanity than possibly you do at this stage. Try for it. I pray for that. The third daunting factor is the misunderstandings between Islam and Christianity. And my time is going like a fire. I see that on the wall. I'm going to keep going ahead until I have to stop. The misunderstandings between Islam and Christianity. You are not with a tabula rasa when you are with Muslims. There is no empty slate. There is something written on that slate. And what is written on that slate is not very good. And so you have to engage in a corrective ministry before you can effectively engage in a proclamatory ministry. That involves a rather careful preparation on your part. What are these misunderstandings? They are the historical misunderstandings. Islam burst out into the existing Christian world, into the Greco-Roman Mediterranean world, which is occupied by Christianity. Took it over. That set the tone. Not quite the way the history books usually say, because Christians became Muslims in great numbers for far less noble reasons than history books usually record. So Islam became the religion of that portion of the world where Christianity had a central home. And then came the Crusades of ill fame. 1097, Pope Urbanus II stood before a great throng in Clermont, France, and preached a sermon. It was a great sermon, but it was not a good sermon. Not all great sermons are good sermons. And he called for an armed crusade to the Holy Land. And the crowd responded, Deus vult. And off they went. Most of them ruffians and brigands. And when they got to Constantinople, the Eastern Orthodox Christians hid their women behind locked doors so they wouldn't be raped by the Western Christians. On down to Jerusalem, 1099, reached the walls of Jerusalem. And one afternoon, they massacred 75,000 Muslim women and children in the streets of Jerusalem. And then they went into the Mosque of Al-Aqsa, sacred place for Islam, where Muslims had given the Jews hiding. And they pulled out the Jews and they killed them too. And I read the accounts of Baldwin the Knight, and he said, and tears of joy rolled down our cheeks as we killed them. So the second thing, as a living memory, Muslims are very bad at forgetting. As a living memory, they'll bring it up. And then came the economic crusades of the 19th century. And we don't pay much attention to, by that I mean the fact that the Western Christian powers one by one went out into the world and claimed every country in the world for Europe. And in the course of that expansion, that colonial expansion, every Muslim country except perhaps one became a colony. And what you have to understand about Muslims connected with this is the fact that Muslims identify Christian, the word Christian, and the West. Think about that. Muslims identify the word Christian and the word West. Everything that emanates from the West is Christian. Everything that appears on our TV is Christian. Everything that our governments do is Christian. They make that immediate conjunction. This is a huge problem. So then it was Christians who colonized us. You did it to us. And then came Palestine, 1948. And so they will talk about this with us. And I remember once my first evangelistic conversation with a Muslim in a tea shop in South India. And he said, why did you do that to us in the Crusades? And I thought to myself, oh, I just graduated from Concordia Seminary and I had all the answers, you know. And I was like a quarterback. I had them written on my... And I was going to look, no, nothing but crusades there. I didn't know what to answer. So I blurted out, I didn't do it. You know. But then the Holy Spirit gave me a better answer. And I said, I'm sorry, we did. And there are things that Christians have to say they're sorry for. And I ask your forgiveness. And Christians ought to be capable of doing that. And many Christians say, why don't, and Muslims who hurt us so badly, why don't they ask us for forgiveness? I said, after you preach the gospel to them and they become Christians, they will. But don't expect them to act like Christians. Apply your same theology to them at this stage. You do what Christ calls you to do. And there are the ideological misunderstandings. And those are very deep and profound, and there's not going to be time to go into them. But they are huge. And they relate to the fundamental things that we want to communicate to Muslims. And I know that all of you are familiar with the fact that Muslims view us people as tritheists. And they feel that we worship three separate deities. And the three deities that we worship are Father, Son, and Mary. And when you invite a Muslim to consider the claims of Christianity, he goes like this. He says, "I'm sorry, I can't. I cannot believe in three gods." And then we have that great phrase in Scripture, Son of God, and the theology of the Son of God, which means so much to us. And in the Quran it says, how could God have married a woman? And I believe that our doctrine of the Son of God means that God had a physical relationship, impregnated a woman, produced a half-man, half-God thing. Now we call the Son of God, and this is our doctrine of the Son of God, and they say, no, I'm sorry, I cannot, and they shouldn't participate in that sort of, because that's not what our teaching is. If you can ask your faculty what our teaching is, I think, you know, as students, I wouldn't ask them what Son of God means. That's really important to get hold of for this. Or I think maybe most of us don't realize that Muslims consider us as idolaters. That is, they consider that we are people who have taken a very, very noble human being. And of course, the great hope in all this is Muslim respect for Jesus is huge, profound. I should have brought some poetry about Jesus written by Muslims along to read it to you. That is a great opportunity. The respect, Muslim respect for Jesus, the Muslim respect for our scriptures, Muslim respect for God. The opportunity to talk about God with Muslims is really a very, very vital thing. The opportunities are tremendous, as well as the difficulties. But they think we're idolaters. Why? Because we have taken a perfectly good human being and elevated him to the stature of God. So if we did that, we would be idolaters. But John 1:14 is other than that. The Word was made flesh and dwelt among us. And when you explain to Muslims what our teaching really is, our eyes become really wide open and thankful. And the cross, I have to mention the cross which is now Lent, and central to our faith and our understanding of the mind of God, that this mind be among you that was in Christ Jesus, our understanding that that is the mind of God. And that our God is a God of suffering love. And therefore he does not stop just by sending prophets, but he sends himself. And he dies on the cross. And the Quran denies that Jesus died on the cross. Where did Muhammad get all these things from? He got them from Christian heresies circling around Arabia at the time he was there. This is the tragedy of the whole thing. And Islam is the religion that, the unnecessary religion, the religion that should never have been. You could not have found out about yours and mine understanding the Christian faith. There was nobody there to give it to him. He couldn't read it. The gospel wasn't available in Arabic. And so he picked up what information he had from what he saw and what he heard, and what he heard and saw was not right. And that God into the Quran was inscripturated as the eternal word of God. And there's our problem. And one of them is that Jesus did not die on the cross. Somebody was substituted for him. Why? Theologically, why? Why, say Muslims? The answer is clear. God would not have allowed it. God would not have allowed this most noble, sinless human being to suffer the death of a criminal on the cross. And so there are great patches of the Apostles' Creed that a Muslim can confess with us. But the things that are missing are really very, very crucial. I want to talk about the emotional misunderstandings that accompany the ideological and the historical ones, because time is running out. Let me just say, how do you deal with misunderstandings? Well, I think you begin to have a relationship with Muslims, so they trust you as a human being. Then they begin to trust what you say. Then they begin to trust the gospel that you share. Until that time, they're not hearing the gospel as gospel. The gospel must not just be preached. It must be heard as gospel. It seems to me sensible to say that. And for that to happen, some relationship has to set in whereby the Muslim says, what you say, I will thoroughly consider. The fourth and final problem is the missiological problem. And here I'm at the point that I've been rehearsing, and I will make this very short, that because of these various issues, historical, ideological, emotional, and so on, that separate Muslims and Christians, because of them all, Muslims have been very resistant to the gospel. And I suppose this is one reason why the church has said, well, we'll do this later. Now, there are places in the world where the opposite is true. And you should go to a place like Indonesia, where 400,000 Muslims have now chosen Christ, 400,000. My wife and I were there, and we went to a church service, and we were hauled up to the front of the church service. And there was no room to sit down anywhere. They found two chairs, finally, and put us in the two chairs, 1,500 people in the church. And we looked around and back, and we knew that every one of those people had been a Muslim. And almost every one of them was under the age of 35. And my wife began to cry. It's all right to cry, to weep in the morning when you see something like that stirs you. And there are places, such as where I work, I didn't have my baptism, the first baptism, for 13 years. I'm glad there were no time efficiency experts and other types of people examining me and saying, cut it off, come home. Rather, we had great visionary mission board secretaries, O.H. Smith and Herman Kuffelman. And I said, no, keep going. And then it happened. I meant to tell you the story how it happened, but time has run out. You really mean that? Okay, well. You see, let me, before I tell the story then, I'll reduce it as much as I can. It's the most stirring story that I personally know. Before that, I say, the mission of God and the mission of our Lord and Savior Jesus Christ in the Muslim world does not depend on the fact that there were 400,000 Muslim baptisms in Indonesia. It doesn't depend on that. It depends on what? On the will of God and on the command of Christ to proclaim his gospel. That's the authority. Not the amount of results at a given moment in history or time. That's not the authority. The authority of the mission and the Lord of the mission is Jesus Christ and his command. And if we are faithful in that faith and in that theology, you may be sure that the Spirit of God will be with what we are doing. And we will be, as C.S. Lewis always said, surprised by joy. And I think that is the experience of many people, even though Somebody like Lilius Trotter worked for 40 years in the North Star Mission in North Africa. And at the end of those 40 years, she had seen about 100 converts, and she wrote, "You know, it is only those who have seen the darkness who can sense the dawn. I see the first light of dawn in the sky." Oh, it was a word of faith. A very powerful woman, Lilius Trotter. Well, in a way, that kind of faith of the great people from the past carries us forward to the doing of the present. And, we had done all the work of evangelism. We lived in the town of Malappuram, which is in southwest India, among the Mapala Muslims, who are considered the most fanatic Muslims in India. And no person had ever become a Christian from that group. And the people who tried to change their religion just before I came there were all murdered. And so they said, "Well, you're wasting your time. And it can't happen." And I said, "Okay, that's probably true, but let's try anyway." And so we did, and we did all the work of classic evangelists do. I won't go into that. There are methodologies. There are things you do, things you don't do. And not much happened. I think a lot more happened than I realized, but formally. And then one day, a couple of young men came to the veranda. And to presage that story, let me tell you that the day before, I had been in the village. And I had been distributing Christian literature, which is a great way of doing work with Muslims. And it had gone very well on that particular day, and my bag was empty. I still remember that. And at the bottom of the bag was one tract. And it was not a very good tract. It's a tract that's theologically very... it's not a very great tract, let me just put it that way. It was dirty because it was down at the bottom of the bag. But these two youngsters came up and said, "But you haven't given us anything." And so I said, "Okay." So I found this thing and I dug it out. And I brought it along. You see, it's got a heart. In the heart, can't see very well, but in the heart, there is a good old Satan standing there with his pitchfork, and there is a tiger and a snake and all sorts of animals, and they're all supposed to signify the demons and the devils and the sins in your heart. That's why I said I don't like this track. You know, it doesn't appeal to my sophisticated, modern view of things. Well, I gave it to them. The next day, I came back. One of the boys' name is Alavi. I want you to remember that name. A-L-A-V-I is the most sterling Lutheran Christian pastor in the world today and working among Muslims. His name was Alavi. And he said, "I read your tract." I said, "Good. And I'm now a Christian." So I said, "Holy smokes, you know, let's say..." You know, it's not possible. You've got to go through catechism. Then you've got to go 2 years, and then you've got to be confirmed. And then this kid. I said, "Okay." So I said, "Well, what should I do?" And I said, "Well, come to Sunday school." It was a desperation move. So he did. He came. He walked 8.5 miles one way on a gimpy leg. He still has that. And back another 8.5 miles. And he came regularly. And he got a Bible as a result of his work. His father, I forgot to say, is a Muslim priest to add to the problems here. And his father saw the Bible and took it away from him and said, "This you should not read because it will bring shame to our family and it will cause us much difficulty." So he took it away, but Alavi found it, and he wrapped it in a plastic bag, and he put a candle in the plastic bag, and he took it to the jungle, and he hid it under a rock. And every night at midnight, he would go out and read the Bible. And he did this for quite a while, until the second of the two boys that had come with him tattled on him, and then he was taken in and hurt badly. And I was again sitting on the veranda with the pastor's wife, the Indian pastor's wife, and Olivier came about distance to the corner there, and he was limping very badly. I said, "Come here, what's the matter?" And he said, "Well, this happened, and my uncle came, and he beat me, and he showed me the bruises were very bad. And he said, I want to go away. I want to go to my sister's house 100 miles away." And he was really asking for money. And now comes the second missionary problem that you would have to face, and that is, what would you say at that point, because he's a minor, he's only 16. And in Indian law, minors are very, very, you don't touch a minor. And what would you do if your 16-year-old son went to a Muslim priest and said he wanted to become a Muslim? What would you want a Muslim priest to do for your son? Think of the golden rule. So I said, "Olivier, you have to go home. And you keep the faith, and when you're 18, which is legal age there, you come out. In the meantime, witness as best you can." He didn't like it very much. He said, "Can I stay in your reading room overnight?" And I said, "Yeah, you can stay in the reading room overnight, but you go home in the morning." So in the reading room, we have customary for people in India to college students to spend 1 year, in voluntary evangelism before they go on to their other stuff. And so we had a very strong-minded youth in there, and his name was George, and he's still in the service of the church. And the next morning, when Olivier was there, a huge mob of people came together with policemen and pounded on the door and said, "Where is the boy that you have kidnapped?" And when George confronted them, said, "No, we haven't kidnapped him. He's here. You can take him home. Don't beat him anymore." While that was going on, other Muslims came who are our friends. There was an argument between our friends and the other people as to whether we were kidnappers or not. And during that altercation, Olivier ran out of the back door and escaped. And he ran and he ran. And he jumped into a canal where he hid for 8 hours. But they found him, to make a long story short, and took him home. And there was a family council. And the three chief brothers in the family came together. And the decision was, what should be done with him? The first uncle said, he should be treated as a Majnun, a madman. And the second uncle said he should be treated as a demon-possessed person. And the third uncle said he should be killed. And that's when his mother fainted. They told me all these stories afterwards when I got close to that family. And it was decided to take the opinion of the first two. He was treated as a madman and as a demon-possessed person. He was thrown on the ground. He was beaten. Pepper water was ground in his eyes to cast out the demons. And then a blacksmith was called, and he was manacled and chained with a heavy chain, placed in a 5-by-5-foot coconut cage on half rations, a prisoner for the gospel. Remember the Old Testament, the New Testament, when there was another person like that. His name was Peter. And the Lord sent an angel. In the same way, he sent an angel. And it was a distant relative who came, was aghast at what he saw, found the key, released Olivier, and Olivier ran. 3 months later, I got a letter from him saying, "Dear sir, I am all right. I'm always saying the Lord's Prayer. Don't worry about me. Yours truly, Olivier." I didn't worry then. 3 months later, midnight, my office. Crickets are chirping. I can hear them now, scratching on the screen. I went out. There's Olivie. And we put our arms around each other and had the grand reunion. And we called the congregation. And we sang songs and hymns of praise. And then I said to Olivie, what are you going to do now? And he said, I have to go home. I said, no, you don't. Because I knew that he would not survive. You can't go home. So I argued with him. He said, I have to go home to preach the gospel to my mother. And finally I shut up when I realized there was something bigger than me here. And the next morning we had prayers again, and Olivie started off. I call it a great walk, because he's a kind of a crazy man, and he had a button, I love Jesus, in Marley Ellum, and he put the button on his chest, and he walked the 8.5 miles, where anybody and everybody, according to their lights, should have been aggressive towards him. And they were so taken by his courage, they reached home, walked in the door, and his mother fainted again. She was always fainting. And 3 hours later, he came back, and I had not known whether he would ever return. So that was very good. Then I said, what do you want to do now? He said, I want to become a Lutheran pastor and preach the gospel to my people. And he did. And he'd been thrown out of school because of all the problems. A brilliant guy, telescoped his education, was baptized while he was at the seminary, came back, and now in his town of Mungeri, he has the most exciting mission you can imagine in the world. And I sat with him in December again. And we have these reunions, and I said, Olivie, how is it with you? It is well. How is it with you? He said, I am well. What is happening? Oh, he said, lots of things. I said, oh, how many people are following you into the Christian church now? He said, 700. 700, I said. We had worked 13 years and had not seen one. And all because of a dirty piece of paper, 700. And last week I got a letter from Pastor Olivie, and time is now up. So I must conclude. I got this letter from him. And he said, we were very tired in December because we received 30,000 letters in December alone from Muslim inquirers into the gospel, of which we were only able to answer 7,000 before our hands got tired. I'd like to call you to, and this church, to the greatest and most demanding task it has faced. And in your saying, here am I think you will discover what I have discovered, that the Lord has opened a great and effectual door to the Muslim heart that no man shall shut. Thank you.
Couple of questions, quickly. Have some?
I'm pretty bad work. I took all the time.
Michael?
Yeah.
Well, that's a very thoughtful question, Mike, and I think the answer would be yes if they knew about it. But Muslims don't pay much attention to the Pope, and they're like Lutherans. And I think we're in a period of time when we're not clear of our clarity. I gave a talk at a Presbyterian church, and after I spoke to the congregation, one of the very formidable people in that church came up to me and said, "Well, I don't think we should be putting Muslims high on the priority." I said, "Why?" I said, "Well, I think we should be putting secular humanity first in our priority. The person down the street who was a Christian and is no longer a Christian. After all, Muslims believe in God." And so I said, "Why punish them for believing in God? I think that's a pretty good thing, that to believe in God. But isn't that a good reason for telling them, you know, Allahu Akbar, God is great, is the most common Muslim devotional phrase, Allahu Akbar, God is great. Isn't that a reason for saying how great God really is?" And that's what I'd say to the Pope. Until the Muslims have heard that, you know, I think the issue is not a live issue.
Yeah, one more.
Yesterday I had a phone call from a Muslim in Iowa. And on, it gives me an opportunity to add something here. June 1 to 4, we're having at Luther Seminary National Student Conference on Islam. I wish there would be 50 students from the seminary there, actually. I wish that. We're going to do a very, very tough 3 days intensive study of Islam. And people like Randy Duncan, who is doing good work for our church in Detroit among Arab Muslims, will be there. And we'll have all-star cast of teachers. And it's a good chance, if you want to start, and if you got June 1 to 4 free, you could come to that. And so I invite you to that and ask you to speak to Dean Smith about it. He knows about it. I got this phone call from Muslims in Sioux City, Iowa. All over the United States, Muslims are phoning me. They've heard about this conference, and their question is, what are you doing with our religion? And when I first taught a class in Islam at the University of Regina, the Muslim Association sent their president, secretary, and treasurer, who were above 50, to enroll for the class. And they did that in order to find out what I was doing with their religion. Muslims want their sacred things to be dealt with fairly and respectfully. If you cannot be fair and respectful, then you, in my view, are not eligible for this work or any work. We have to be fair and respectful. So this guy phones up. He's a lawyer. He said, "I happen to be a member of the oldest Muslim family in the United States. 100 years ago, we came to Iowa." So that's good. You get a different phone call from everybody. And so I wondered what the angle was here. He said, "I've heard about your conference. I want to come." I said, "Well, I'm 50 years old." I said, "Are you a student?" "No." I said, "Well, the answer is no. And but I want to meet you. And why do you want to come?" "Because I want a dialogue with Christians. I'm sick and tired of Christians coming to my door, walking in my family, and telling me I have a cancer in my heart in front of my children who don't understand what they're saying. And I'm sick and tired of what's called Christian evangelism. And I want to say that. I said, well, you could say that. You just said it to me. And not everything that Christian evangelists do is good. And not everything that Christian evangelists do I agree with. Certainly, some Christian evangelists cause more trouble than help in this particular mission. I said, I want to find out what you're going to say about mission in that conference. What do you say about mission? Then he hit me. Your question, you know, in effect, both your questions, what do you say about it? Well, I said, I don't believe that I don't believe that anyone who has something worthwhile in their life should not share it with another human being. Whatever you have worthwhile in your life, you should be sharing with other people. Whatever is rich and true and beautiful in your life, you should share it. What do you think of that? Blah, 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 blah. He said he didn't quite know what to say then because he knew what. And then I said, Muslims have a lot that they are sharing. You want to come to this conference because you want to share your views. So don't be so hard on Christians who want to share their good things with you. The question is not whether we do mission or whether we share. The question is how we do it. Ladies and gentlemen, the question is how we do it. And if we do it with love and concern and compassion, the Muslims will embrace you. They will embrace you. In December, when they heard I was there, these people who would have done very great harm to me at one stage, they heard I'd come, and they invited me to a public meeting with 1,500 Muslims, and I was the only Christian there. And then they hauled me up on the stage, and then they coerced a member of parliament, and somehow they had got a beautiful briefcase, and they presented it to me as a gift of love. And then I had to speak in Malayalam for 15 minutes after not having spoken Malayalam for a while. That was a trial. And then they gave me a tender coconut. A tender coconut is a coconut where it's just the juice is there, you know, it's not growing yet, and you sip it through a soft straw, and the most beautiful, delicious drink in the world. But you see, what they were saying was, we want to give you our love. Here's a tender coconut. Salaam alaikum. I want you to hear that word from Muslims and come close enough to them. Come very close to the point where they will see a power in you and they will ask you, well, what is there about this Jesus that makes you do these things? And then you share with them the beautiful and wonderful gospel of God.